meet our third patient, Demetria, who was diagnosed with hormone receptor negative, HER2 negative cancer in 2004. Demetria lives in Chicago, Illinois.
I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. I love the lakefront because it's very relaxing. I come and look at the boats, and I think about myself going through the cancer. I was 41 years old, and one day I came from the gym. I start giving myself breast exams, as I always have, and I noticed that there was a lump on the left side of my breast. The doctor examined my breast, and she said I needed to have a biopsy done. She called me, like, the next day and told me that it was cancerous.
She said she had some bad news, and I said, what was it? And she told me that the doctor told her she had cancer.
The first thing, you know, you do is you panic.
Cold chills went through my body.
For these triple-negative breast cancers, I really look at whether chemotherapy is going to help them live longer, help them live better. Demetria is young and can tolerate chemotherapy pretty well, but we don't want her to be sicker from the chemotherapy than she ever would be from the breast cancer.
Some days you just feel good, some days you feel like crap, you know? It's like a wave. It goes up and down. After that, I had to do 36 treatments of radiation.
She was cancer-free, and we prayed and thanked God for it. And it was 5 years.
Words of encouragement from someone who believes in you. Somehow you're going to make this work out.
I was 46 years old. I was still working, and I was sitting at my desk, and I kept spitting and coughing, and fluids kept coming up, and I didn't understand what was going on.
The little nodule that they were talking
about. We found that she had disease that had spread to her lungs.
Around the lungs, which has gotten...
We talked about two general options. One was standard chemotherapy, and the other one was different drugs and different combinations of drugs, and that is what she initially went on. That did not work too well. We had to try different new chemotherapeutic drugs, which she is currently on. The benefit is that she will live longer and healthier and have a better quality of life. The risk is that every time that Demetria gets chemotherapy, she may have side effects from the chemotherapy.
There's the nauseating, there's the fatigue, there's the numbness. As you can see, the hair has fallen out, but it's trying to come back.
This picture is much better than the picture we had 3 months ago. The chemotherapy has worked. Demetria's cancer at some point is going to become resistant to the chemotherapy drugs that we have. That means that the cancer cells will outsmart us and outsmart the chemotherapy and find ways to grow, although we're still feeding them with the chemotherapy. And then we'll have to talk about other treatments, anything that we can offer her at that point to again stall the breast cancer. But it's extremely important for patients to ask their doctors what their quality of life is going to be. And the quality of life can change from our treatment, because chemotherapy can compromise the quality of life. It can also change from the cancer, because cancer can cause symptoms as well.
Yes, gateway 3 would be a glass and stone.
When you are going through cancer, you have to have a positive attitude.
Yes, it's beautiful.
I just say every day, always thank God for waking me up, giving me strength, and helping me through this battle.
Thank you for being out here with me.
You're welcome.
Well, my colleague, Dr. Kaklamani, is caring for this patient, and I think this patient represents a challenging problem that we've discuss a little bit about, and that is triple negative disease. And I think this is really the focus of a lot of the research that's ongoing. In the absence of a target, we're sort of proceeding blindly with standard therapies because we don't know necessarily what will work in such patients.
So how would you consider sequencing chemotherapy for a patient like Demetria? What's the best agent or agents?
There isn't a specific agent. There, again, are many things that may work, and usually you have to think about what else is going on with the patient. For example, if someone had an underlying heart disease, there are a group of drugs called anthracyclines we would avoid. One large group of drugs that we use are taxanes. Maybe people have, they often are complicated by neuropathy, and depending on their side effects, we may choose to avoid those or pick and choose between the different ones. Sometimes we pick things that are easier, that the schedule is easier to give to the patient. They're oral choices, and if people travel long ways, travel long distances, we may choose to use an oral approach. There's some drugs that are sequenced weekly, which may be more of a challenge, so we have to take into account their comorbidities, where they live, what their goals are, the side effects of the treatment. But there's no specific sequence that can be endorsed, I do not believe.
Demetria's doctor mentioned the need to move on to other treatments when her cancer outsmarts the current chemotherapy. What new drugs or combinations might one consider?
I think one of the most exciting options now is an experimental group of drugs called PARP inhibitors. At the last large meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, there was a small trial that was reported where people took a combination of chemotherapy plus or minus one of these new drugs, a PARP inhibitor, and it suggested that in women with triple negative disease that there may be dramatic improvements in progression-free survival and perhaps overall survival as well. This was a small trial. These are not commercially available, but it points out the fact that clinical research is often a gateway to obtain access to new things that hopefully prove to be more beneficial. Most of the things that we use now and are commonplace were components of clinical trials in the past. So yes, there's lots of new things out there. Again, clinical trials are a gateway to those, I believe.
Demetria's doctor spent a lot of time really considering what would be the best treatment options for her age, how she would handle the chemotherapy, which different treatments would affect her in different ways. How do you help patients understand the risks and benefits of the variety of treatment options?
I think that's a huge challenge. A lot of what we try and do has to do with science, but this actual piece you're talking about has little to do with science. It has to do with interacting with people. And I think that most breast cancer patients, compared to other types, seem to be very well prepared. Most of them come with somebody else, somebody who comes prepared with a list of questions. In this web-savvy era, I would say that there are lists of what you should ask your doctor.
I would agree with what John said. This is a very challenging part of the discussion with a patient with metastatic disease, because on the one hand, you want to be able to tell them what your best opinion is about how to approach their disease. On the other hand, the evidence supporting one over the other is not as clear-cut that you're going to choose A versus B and the outcome will be better. So it gets back to the issue of individualizing therapy based on side effect profile of the drugs you're using, prior therapy the patient's had, also what the overall condition of the patient is. And then underlying all of this is if we have a clinical trial that's appropriate for a patient, it's always sort of our first choice to at least discuss that with the patient because it may turn out that that indeed is their best choice.
And I can't emphasize enough what John said about communication, bringing somebody with you, even if it's a patient you know well. They're really nervous. They're having a change in their treatment. They're having a change often in the goals of the treatment, and they don't always hear what you say. So having a spouse, a best friend, even two or three people in the room at the same time, I think really helps us get the message to the patient and her family.
You talked about the importance of an individualized plan, and Colleen, one of the patients that we met earlier in the program, has now developed bone metastases. How does this influence the treatment that you would offer her?
Well, it influences it in a couple of ways. Number one, is whether or not the bone disease is isolated. So oftentimes bone-only disease, although that's not a good thing, it's still metastatic disease, bone-only disease can be a more indolent course. Oftentimes these patients have symptoms that find their way to Beryl McCormick and other subspecialists who focus on palliating focused areas. But the other implication is that we may use therapies that are focused on building bone, supporting bone, trying to decrease the comorbidities related to skeletal metastases, such as bisphosphonates. And the broader implication of bisphosphonates we're now exploring is whether or not by themselves they may be an anti-cancer therapy for early-stage patients. But in patients with metastatic disease, they are a companion to whatever the usual systemic therapy is. So if a patient's getting endocrine therapy, they're also going to get a bisphosphonate. If they're getting chemotherapy with or without trastuzumab, they're going to get a bisphosphonate if they have bone disease. So I think it's a component of our therapy for patients with metastatic disease involving the bone.
We're actually interested now in a few clinical trials, if it's only in one or two bones, giving quite high dose radiation to that area to see if we can get a much longer palliation of pain and actually have the bone heal.
We've been talking about the use of bisphosphonates in women with metastatic breast cancer. People have heard about a rare side effect called osteonecrosis of the jaw that is quite intimidating, and many women or their physicians or their dentists may be scared to use this agent because of this unusual complication. That can happen, but it is unusual, and the prevalence and the importance of bone metastatic disease in terms of the quality of a woman's life is so critical that for most women it clearly outweighs the rare side effect. So we need to be aware of it, we need to think about it, but it should not dissuade us from using this important group of drugs.
So bisphosphonates are recommended for women who develop bone metastases and for women who develop certain other bone problems along with treatment. What role does surgery play?
Surgery really plays a very limited role in terms of the management of patients with stage 4 disease. I think the most common cases at Memorial would be either patients with very symptomatic large metastases of their brain, where sometimes relief of the pressure helps immediately relieve the symptoms, and the neurosurgeon will sometimes be asked to see the case rather than the alternate treatment for a smaller, less symptomatic brain metastasis, which is often what we call stereotactic radiosurgery. I think the other major role is in some bones that are weight-bearing, where the radiologist is often saying there is an impending fracture and the patient is otherwise in good condition. Oftentimes, the orthopedic surgeon will stabilize that bone and then will follow it with local radiation.
What about the role of radiation in regards to treating women with metastatic breast cancer?
Radiation has a very important role. Most breast cancers are very responsive to radiation. We can address bone pain, isolated brain lesions, bleeding, many, many symptoms that the patients actually have from the breast cancers. And so I would estimate at least half of patients with stage 4 breast cancer at some point are in my office getting a limited course of radiation, a very different time span in general than the 5 to 6 weeks of radiation that's usually used at diagnosis. This is generally much shorter. It can be anything from a single high-dose course of radiation really directed by imaging to a certain spot in the bone, for example, to a course of radiation to relieve pain that's usually no more than 10 trips back and forth to our department. But it's effective treatment. It's also a treatment we can give a lot with these new biological agents, not so much running into some of the problems that we do with traditional systemic chemotherapy.
There are many supportive care issues to consider. For example, nausea during chemotherapy. Also, you've mentioned pain. Where can clinicians go to learn more about this type of supportive care?
Well, the NCCN guidelines offer insights into how you approach many of these different problems. And, you know, in many of our centers, we view the term palliative care as not necessarily end of life, but an adjunct to the therapy that we're currently giving. So we often call upon our colleagues who focus on symptom management in a way that helps us manage those patients who have difficulties with significant pain or nausea that seems persistent despite the usual maneuvers. And I think that, you know, as we've stated many times over the course of this discussion, we always want to make the therapy effective, but not at a cost that it limits the quality of life of a patient. And the equation has to be such that you come out ahead with therapy. It's not worse than the disease. And I think that's why the focus on trying to manage symptoms is critical. And I should point out that probably one of the key people involved in managing symptoms, we like to think we play a huge role. It's actually the nurses that take care of the patients, because they're the ones who see the patients oftentimes more one-on-one, spend more time than we have available to us to really probe what's really bothering them. So they're a critical player in managing the care of patients.
At what point do you halt treatment and move to palliative care?
That's always a huge challenge. We have such a long list of potentially active agents that many people want to keep going and trying newer and newer things, going farther down the list. But there is a time where that doesn't make a lot of sense. Our guidelines suggest that if people aren't responding to, I believe, three or more chemotherapy regimens, that we should talk about palliative care or hospice. I believe that any time we're talking about a disease that isn't, that cannot be cured and which you're managing, you should always mention that no treatment is one option and that they don't have to be forced, coerced, or feel like they must undergo treatment because it's there, that just because you can do something doesn't mean you have to do something. I think sometimes patients do treatment because they feel they should do it for their family or for their spouse or for their friends, who will somehow think them less if they don't do it. But I think that the patient should always have the option of saying enough is enough. But then we as physicians have to be frank with patients when we feel like enough is enough, and we should shift our focus to palliative care, taking care of every symptom that comes up and accepting the fact that we cannot alter the course of the disease.
The reality is that it's only going to work, meaning objective regression, shrinkage of the disease, in a small fraction of patients as you get to the fourth, fifth, sixth line therapy, if it works at all. But they're all going to have side effects, so I think we always have to revisit that idea.
Well, before we end our conversation about caring for patients with metastatic breast cancer, perhaps you could summarize a couple of the key points for your colleagues who've been watching the program.
I think the most important thing from my standpoint is that biology drives the management of disease. We know that hormone receptors status and HER2 status currently tells us which direction to go, and we hope that there will be other biologic drivers in the future that will help us fine-tune and individualize our therapies. The other point that is critical to me is trying to decide if the risks of a treatment are worth the benefits, or perhaps a different way of putting that is the juice worth the squeeze?
Emphasizing to the patient and her family that having stage 4 disease is something that really can be effectively treated for many months and often many years, as you've just heard, is such an important thing to communicate. You can have stage 4 disease and still have a good quality of life, as many of our patients have shown on the videos for a long period of time. And I think the other important thing is to communicate with the patient as she goes along at each stage of her treatment. What are her options?
And trying to add something that my colleagues haven't already stated, you know, I would just emphasize again that clinical trials are critical. And I think as John and Beryl have pointed out before, therapies that we view as standard of care now were once the subject of clinical trials. And it's only by participating in those trials that we found that they were better than whatever preceded them. And as we enter an era where there's a lot of biologic therapy, where we're understanding the underpinnings of why cancer progresses, we're identifying an enormous number of potential agents and potential targets. And it's only by, you know, really encouraging patients to participate in clinical trials that we'll be able to move new therapies forward and hopefully improve the outcome of patients with advanced disease.
Much of our discussion today has been based on guidelines from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. You can find those guidelines online at www.nccn.org. You'll also find a link to that site at discoveryhealthcme.com. The patients, their families, and their caregivers can also visit nccn.com. That's a new website for consumers with NCCN treatment summaries, information, and advice. Again, thank you all for joining us in this important conversation. And I'd also like to thank our viewers, and we hope that today's program has given you useful information about caring for patients with metastatic breast cancer. Also, we encourage each of you to go to your computer, log on to discoveryhealthcme.com, and take the post test. It only takes a few minutes to earn free credit for this program. And if you'd like to see it again, you can watch it online, download a podcast, or order a DVD. All the graphics and references from this program are also available online. Finally, we'd like to thank the National Comprehensive Cancer Network for accrediting and for collaborating with Discovery Health on the content of this program, as well as our supporters, AstraZeneca, Genentech, GlaxoSmithKline, and Pfizer. Once again, you can download the NCCN guidelines at nccn.org. I'm Rhea Blakey. Join us next time for Discovery Health CME.